Good evening, everybody, and welcome back. Thank you so much for joining us again for the fifth lecture in our Parental Guidance Suggested series. Just to make sure that everybody's aware that the sixth and final lecture will be this coming Sunday night. It will not be a week from tonight or Tuesday. That was the one that was rescheduled from a couple of weeks ago, stepping in and stepping aside, inspiring your independence in a scary world. If you're not able to make it Sunday night, all of the classes have been posted on the shul website on YU Torah, so you can make up whatever you missed. Okay, so tonight we're going to talk about square pegs and round holes, Torah perspectives on raising challenging children. Very important topic, and needless to say, the expression challenging children is by definition a relative one. We could all, and perhaps on a certain level, we do consider parenting in general to be challenging. But then, of course, there are circumstances where it just seems that sometimes certain children tend to be a little more challenging than others. And it's that particular phenomenon I want to speak about tonight. A couple of disclaimers. Number one, there are never any guarantees in life, especially when it comes to parenting. So tonight's lecture is particularly... it could be anyway, particularly sensitive in nature. And I want to make very clear from the outset that I don't mean to suggest by anything that I say that that if you follow the instructions that I'm going to provide tonight, then somehow you have a guarantee that you'll have no challenges in parenting. Certainly not. And perhaps that's so obvious it doesn't need to be stated, but I do so anyway. Of course, there are best practices, but there's no magic bullet. There's no perfect recipe. And really, what we're going to do in the hour or less that we have tonight is just talk about some very basic general ideas. But the goal over here is not to provide the perfect formula. Of course, if it existed, I would be happy to share it with you. We should never assess anyone else's parenting or parental skills or abilities, nor judge someone else's parenting performance. Obviously, I'm not speaking about anybody in particular tonight. I don't have anybody in mind. And in general, when we speak about this topic, when we think about it, and we share ideas and thoughts with each other, we should be careful to sort of mind their own business. If somebody is seeking our counsel or advice, obviously it's okay to share your thoughts with someone. But we should be very careful, particularly when it comes to this area, not to be judgmental. We don't really know the sort of circumstances and situations that people are facing. And I want to preface tonight's lecture by saying I don't want anybody to feel guilty. That's certainly not the goal of tonight's lecture. We're not looking to induce guilt. I'm not looking to make anybody feel bad. Oh, if I only had known this, 5 years ago, 10 years ago, so my child would be that much different. Probably not. First of all, again, there's really nothing so profound that I intend on sharing with you tonight anyway. But we're here to learn together, to talk together, to share ideas, and I wouldn't want anybody walking out of here feeling guilty. So I hope that doesn't happen. Okay, I'm just going back to one slide that we had in the first in the first lecture, and so it may seem familiar. I think it's just important to just sort of segue into tonight's discussion. Would it not be more ideal if there was a version of what to expect when you're expecting for every month of a child's life? Would it not be more ideal if each child came with an individualized and personalized set of instructions? Would it not be more ideal if one single parenting method and approach worked for every child? Would it not be more ideal if we would receive real-time, instant feedback and could be certain that our parenting styles and approaches were effective? Wouldn't this be wonderful, and wouldn't it be ideal? And the answer, of course, is no. It would not be ideal. It would be easier, but not ideal. And we're not going to go back to the entire first presentation, but I think it's important to realize and to remind ourselves, not just tonight, but perhaps each and every day when we are out there trying to parent our children, that whatever we are facing is part of the ideal experience. It may not feel like it, may not seem like it, and perhaps we would have preferred the easier approach, the easier method, but the reality is that as far as our rabbis teach us, parenting by definition is one that is challenging. It's one which is described as we seen earlier, as amelus, as something which is full of toil. Chazal speak about tsar gidol banim, a certain pain that is associated with raising children. And so therefore, by definition, if that's part of God's plan for the world and for us as parents, then that represents the ideal. So who or what is a challenging child? So we could mean many different things when we speak of challenging children. So I'm going to present a possible list in no particular order of what we may be mean when we speak about challenging children. A child who is unhappy or easily agitated. A child who is unmanageable, who has unmanageable academic struggles in school. A child who has unhealthy expressions of anger. A child who struggles in building or maintaining social connections. A child who is very needy or dependent on his or her parents. A child who lacks the ability to self-soothe. A child who is overly mischievous and rebellious. A child who is unusually withdrawn. A child with erratic, extreme shifts in mood. A child who bullies other children. A child who engages in bizarre or disturbing behavior. And of course, perhaps you're one of the lucky parents who has a child that does all of these. That was a joke. You could laugh. These are some examples of the sort of challenges that we sometimes face as parents. Hopefully, these are these are extreme examples in some respects, and there is a continuum. We are not speaking in absolute black and white terms over here, and we can have situations where our children, just like us, go through different stages in life, and there may be a particular reason why suddenly my child is struggling in school, or suddenly seems very needy or very dependent on his parents, where until now he hasn't been. But in general, these are the types of acute challenges that parents face when it comes to raising children. And the question is, are challenging children a new phenomenon or not? Is this concept of having difficult children with these whole array of issues that I just mentioned, is this new? Is this unprecedented? Have we experienced this before in our history? And so what I have over here is a family tree of the Bible. It was hard to find one which I could fit on one page. It starts with Adam and Eve on top, and it goes all the way down to basically the Moshe and Aaron and their children. So it spans, of course, many generations. Many of the names on here will be familiar to us. We're not going to read them all right now. Nor am I going to identify or highlight any particular specific individuals. But now that Sefer Bereishis is fresh in our mind, because we just began Sefer Shmos last week, so Sefer Bereishis really is a book of families. It's a book of people. It's a book of a lot of stories and people and families which perhaps, if they were living today, we would describe as dysfunctional. We wouldn't use that word, and we shouldn't use that word when describing biblical figures. It's not necessarily a respectful and perhaps not a productive term to use to describe them. But if we think about it objectively, and we really try to learn from the Torah and to take away messages that we can apply to our lives, so of course we come to the realization that challenging children is not a new phenomenon. And in fact, the Torah tells us again and again and again about parents who had to raise very difficult children and face some very difficult parenting situations. So the first lesson of tonight, when we speak about parenting challenging children, is accept your children for who they are and who they are not. This is important. Obviously, each and every one of us love our children, and we care about our children, and we want to be great parents. And it's not just because you're here, because I say that, because it's a given. It's always that way. But sometimes we struggle with being able to truly accept our children for who they are. And that is, to a certain extent, a failure on our part. And in order to be effective parents and nurturing parents and parents that can motivate our children and help them cope with the challenges that they face, so we have to accept our children for who they are. The Ramban, in his introduction to Sefer Bereishis, wonders, why is it that we have so many stories in Sefer Bereishis? I just mentioned moments ago that Sefer Bereishis is basically a storybook. In the entire Sefer, one-fifth of the Torah, there are three mitzvos. It's certainly not a book of mitzvos, not a book of laws. Sefer Bereishis, says the Ramban, is there, HaTorah yichlol hasipurim mitchilas Bereishis. The Torah includes all of the stories from the beginning of creation. Ki hu moreh anoshim bederech b'inyan ha'amuna. Because it is basically a guide for people to know how to navigate their way through difficult situations in life, situations which require emunah, faith. Now, of course, when we speak about emunah, we speak about emunah, faith in God. But an important component of faith is faith in ourselves, faith in each other, faith in our children. And again, going back to what we said before, if we learn Sefer Bereishis properly, so we will be able to extract many very important, timeless messages that we can incorporate into our lives, again, for the purpose of tonight's discussion, particularly as parents. So one, perhaps, very famous example is that the Torah in Parshas Toldos describes Yaakov and Esav, twin brothers born to Yitzchak and Rivka. And the Torah tells us that from the very beginning of their birth, they were different. Actually, the Torah seems to imply that even before they were born, they were very different. Certainly the Midrash Chazal elaborate on that idea. But once they were born, we were able to tell right away that maybe they were twins, but they did not share the same physical features. They look different. They seem to have different temperaments. And the Torah tells us, Vayigdilu ha'na'arim. These boys, they got a little older. Vayhi Esav ish yodeyat tzayin ish sadeh. And Esav was a person, we'll follow the simple reading of the Pasuk, because there are many Midrashic interpretations, was a person who had certain hunting skills. He was a man of the field. Vayakov ish tam, yoshev olim. Yaakov was a little more simple. He was, in some ways, perhaps a little less adept out in the field. He didn't seem to have possessed those natural hunting abilities. And he was someone who, we would say today, stayed at home. Again, Chazal tell us, Yoshev Ohalim means that he spent time in the Beis Medrash and studying Torah. But on a very simple level, we see that they were very, very different individuals with different personalities. So how were they raised? How did their parents, how were they mechanich them? We've been speaking about chinuch. How were Yitzchak and Rivka mechanich their children, Yaakov and Esav? So in a very famous commentary, Rav Shamshon Rafal Hirsch in his Perush on Chumash says as follows. Our sages, who never objected to draw attention to the small and great mistakes and weaknesses in the history of our great forefathers, and therefore thereby make them just the more instructive for us, here too on Vayigdalu make a remark which is indeed a signpost for all of us. They point out that the striking contrast in the grandchildren of Abraham may have been due not so much to a difference in the temperaments as to mistakes in the way that they were brought up. As long as they were little, no attention was paid to the slumbering differences in their natures. Both had exactly the same teaching and educational treatment, and the great law of education, Chanoch Lenaro Pidarko, was forgotten. That each child must be treated differently, with an eye to the slumbering tendencies of his nature, and out of them be educated to develop his special characteristics for the one pure human and Jewish life. The great Jewish task in life is basically simple, one and the same for all. But in its realization, is it as complicated and varies as human natures and tendencies are varied, and the manifold varieties of life that result from them. So if Hirsch writes, quite profoundly, that perhaps Yaakov and Esav were not raised quite the way they should be. In what way? Well, they were raised with a very, very similar approach. Now, Rav Hirsch doesn't elaborate as to what exactly that approach was, but he points out that the Torah tells us that Yaakov and Esav were different, and they developed in very different ways. And we don't want to oversimplify things too much for the moment, but it's fair to say that Yaakov went in one direction, and Esav went in the other direction. Why is that? So we can speculate all we want, but Rav Hirsch suggests because of the fact that not enough attention was given to their, as he called them, slumbering tendencies, to the differences, to the nuances with which they both had. The next pasuk, the very next pasuk says, "Vayehav Yitzchak es Esav kitzai b'fiv, v'Rivka oheves es Yaakov." That Yitzchak loved Esav because, again, as we saw beforehand, he was a hunter, kitzayid b'fiv. Literally, the hunt was in his mouth. V'rivka oheves es Yaakov. Now, I'd like to spend a couple of minutes just talking about this pasuk. What does this pasuk sound like it's saying? What does it sound like? It sounds like the pasuk is saying that
they had favorites.
But more than that, it says that Yitzchak loved Esav and Rivka loved Yaakov. So first and foremost, it sounds like they didn't just have favorites. They picked sides. I mean, right? And if that's so my question is, how could that be? How could it be that they each love one of their children? I can't accept that interpretation. It's just impossible to accept. And not only, by the way, because we want to give them the benefit of the doubt, because after all, they are Yitzchak and Rivka, and they deserve that and much more, but because they're human beings and they're parents, and parents, by definition, love their children, and that love is not something which we can be quantified, not something that can be divided. And so therefore, what does the pasuk mean? Well, maybe it means, as was suggested, that they have favorites. That Yitzchak loved Esav more, and Rivka loved Yaakov more. But here again, it's really hard for me to accept that that's so. It's really hard for me to believe that Yitzchak actually loved one of his sons more than the other, and Rivka loved one of her sons more than the other. Can anybody here imagine, and please don't raise your hand, loving one of your children more than the other? I mean, it's something which is really, it's really hard to imagine. It's hard to accept. And the Torah here seems to be saying, almost casually, that Yitzchak loved Esav and Rivka loved Yaakov. Rashi tells us that Yitzchak was fooled. On the pasuk, Vayev Yitzchak is Esav kitzai befiv, that Esav was somebody who was very good at fooling his father. He spoke to him in a certain way, which displayed a very, very sincere and genuine concern about his father's well-being. He demonstrated commitment to the mitzvah of Kibbut Avayim. His father was fooled by that. And here again, I ask, could it really be that Yitzchak was so blind to the truth? Could it really be that we are all reading the story and we understand the truth? We know who Esav was, and Yitzchak was somehow so oblivious to that. So, I want to suggest, possibly, that maybe we are sort of missing the point of what the Torah is trying to say over here. Maybe, in fact, as I've suggested, both Yitzchak and Rivka had boundless, immeasurable love for each and every one of their children, and they did not in any way whatsoever favor in their hearts any one of their children. But perhaps what the Torah means to suggest over here is that each parent demonstrated more love for each child more than the other. Each parent acted as if there was more love for one child than the other. Whereas Rivka was able to shower her son Yaakov with love and encouragement and support, she had apparently a difficult time demonstrating the same degree of acceptance of her son Esav. Without a doubt, if you would have been able to probe into her heart, it would reveal immeasurable love for both. Yet, she was unwilling, or perhaps maybe unable, or maybe it was a calculated choice on her part to motivate Esav. But somehow, the impression that we are given is that Rivka oheves is Yaakov. Rivka loves Yaakov. Not that she truly loved Yaakov more than Esav, but that's certainly an impression that we get. And when the Torah tells us that Yitzchak loved Esav, what this means is, yeah, he must have been incredibly impressed with the hasmada of Yaakov Avinu, his attention to his spiritual development, but he was equally, if perhaps to a certain extent, even more impressed with whatever redeeming qualities he saw in his son Esav. It is true that unlike his brother Yaakov, his spiritual side was underdeveloped. He was not necessarily as refined in his mannerisms and his speech, yet Yitzchak saw tremendous potential, and he tried to shower him with praise. And he was able to demonstrate sincere acceptance of his son Esav, Basher Husham. So perhaps the Torah over here is describing not really what they felt, but the impression that was given, the impression that was created in the household. I understand that this suggestion may sound a little radical. It may sound like the kind of thing, well, how could you say that, Rabbi? And I respect that completely, but I would just challenge you to tell me, how do you interpret this pasuk? You know, how can we possibly interpret this pasuk in a way that is complementary? And I think what I'm trying to do is suggest the most complementary explanation possible. And that is that they really both love their children very much, but somehow it was naturally easier for one to display that love to one child than the other to the other. And the truth of the matter is this interpretation is consistent with an idea that I haven't shared here, but elsewhere in other discussions, when the Torah tells us, Vayar Hashem kisnu aleya, that God observes, God sees that Leah was hated by Yaakov, many of the Mefarshim point out that that's not really fair, because nowhere does it say that Yaakov hated Leah, it just says that he loved Rachel more. But the Mefarshim conclude, many, that, but that's exactly the point. The fact that Leah felt hated means that she was hated. Yaakov didn't think that, he didn't feel that, he didn't act that way, But if that's what she felt, well, then the Torah paskins that she is snua. And to a certain extent over here, I'm sort of saying the same idea, that Yitzchak demonstrates a certain acceptance of his son Esav, which projects as Ava, and Rivka, the same for Yaakov. And the bottom line is, our children are who they are, and that is something that we need to accept, and we need to accept happily. And perhaps I would say the greatest challenge in raising challenging children is not our children, but it's our own acceptance, and accepting our children for who they are, loving them for who they are, and building them up accordingly. Last week I quoted from book The Blessings of a B-, from Wendy Mogul, and I quote from her again. It is natural, and this is sort of a deeper twist on this concern, it is natural for parents to nurture both public and secret dreams for their children's future. Yet these dreams should be based on the child's actual desires and abilities, not the ones we might wish for them to have. So many sensible, intelligent, devoted parents imagine a future for their child that goes something like this. Our son gets straight A's and is captain of the lacrosse team. He's designed a web program to help teachers create their own computerized multi-choice test, and it's been such a success that the profits will cover the small gap between his tuition and the giant scholarship offered him by his college of his choice. And oh, he and his girlfriend give surf lessons to underprivileged children in the summer. Parents who can't accept themselves, their own lives, or looks, or achievements, are especially at risk for wanting their children to be everything they're not. I frequently talk to parents who are angry at their teens for not being better students, athletes, competitors, or leaders. When their children disappoint them, the parents take it very, very personally. You were supposed to play the cello, or at least the guitar. You were supposed to love reading. You weren't supposed to struggle with weight like I have my entire life, and especially not lose the struggle so publicly. You weren't supposed to get in trouble at the school where I am a board member. You weren't supposed to be so socially awkward when you have such supportive, emotionally literate parents. Parents who transfer their disappointments onto their teenagers are falling into what is probably an age-old trap. It's always been easy for parents to see teens as their last shot at realizing all their old, unlived dreams. But I think it's more common now because teens have few other obvious functions in the family. It was once standard practice for a community to harness the natural energy and bravado of teenagers, putting them to work as farmhands or domestic help or tribal guardsmen. Today, most of our teens are protected from anything that looks like rough or dangerous labor. We put them to work in a different way, studying until midnight and spending all weekend at travel hockey tournaments. Their job? To bring glory and reassurance to the family. Parents rarely acknowledge these goals for their teens out loud, but if they did, it would sound something like this. If Marnie boosts her SATs by just 100 points, we'll have it made. Together with the rest of her profile, this will make her the star of the class. Score one for stay-at-home moms. Now that Tyler is playing varsity soccer and is captain of the swim team, my father might finally appreciate that which I've done with my life, and I've done my life measures up compared to his other grandchildren. There's no contest. So, the first lesson of tonight's talk on raising challenging children is to love our kids for who they are, accept them for who they are and for who they're not, and to make sure not to project our own personal insecurities or our own disappointments with who we are or who we're not onto our children. The second lesson for tonight is don't try to change your child. This will also bring us back briefly, at least initially, to something we said in the first lecture. Famous pasuk, perhaps the most often cited pasuk when we speak about chinuch, chanoch l'naro pidarko, that you should raise your child in accordance with his way, and gam ki yazkin lo yasir mimena, which, as we pointed out last time, would most often be explained to mean, if you educate your child appropriately in accordance with his way, so then he will hold on to it for the rest of his life. Even when he becomes a zakein, he will not deviate from that path. And I certainly couldn't tell you that that's a wrong way to read the pasuk, but it's not the way the Vilna Gaon reads the pasuk. He explains, as we had explained previously, that every person has a teva. Every person has a nature, and more or less, that is who we are. Of course, there's much that we can and we must do with ourselves to improve ourselves, to perfect ourselves, to harness our strengths, our abilities, to learn to control our challenges, our weaknesses. There's a lot of work to do. But more or less, we are who we are. And the Vilna Gaon explains that this pasuk is not telling us that if we educate our children properly, then maybe it'll stick when they get older. No, the pasuk is saying, educate your child in accordance with his way, Because even when he gets older, he's not going to change who he is. And for us to ignore that, for us to pretend that our child is someone else, is doing them and us a great disservice. Rabbi Baruch Simon in the Sefer Imei Baruch points out, Udvarav HaKadoshim Hem Yisod Gadol B'Darchei HaChinuch. The holy words of the Vilna Gaon are really a foundation of Chinuch. Ki Ari B'chol Adam Madbi'a HaKadosh Baruch Hu Teva Mesuyam Shekashem Od L'Shanoso. Every person has a nature which is hard to break. B'Yakein Kasher Mavchinim Horim Amorim B'Teva Mesuyam Shel B'Damon Tamidam. When parents or teachers recognize the unique nature of their children, of their students, Bal Yinasu L'Shanoso. Don't try to change it. Ki Hu Lo Tislach. You will not succeed. And even if it seems you're succeeding, don't be too happy. Perhaps this is just because they are respecting, honoring, or perhaps revering the parent at this particular point. What a parent should do is try to help our children recognize how they can use what they have been given to become great people. As the example that the Vilna Gaon gives based on the Gemara, people can have certain tendencies and they can be used for many, many different types of professions and engagements. And that is our job as parents. Not to change our kids, but to celebrate who they are and help them achieve success in that state. Coincidentally, this was just sent this morning. This was sent on a family WhatsApp group from one of my sister-in-law. It's not very well written, but it's sort of timely because many of our kids are taking finals right now, and it's timely because I received it this morning. A school principal in Singapore sent this letter to me, sent to the parents before the exams. Dear parents, the exams of your children are to start soon. I know you are all really anxious for your child to do well. But please do remember, among the students who will be sitting for the exams, there is an artist who doesn't need to understand math. There is an entrepreneur who doesn't care about history or English literature. There is a musician whose chemistry marks won't matter. There is an athlete whose physical fitness is more important than physics. If your child doesn't get top marks, that's great. But if he or she doesn't, I'm sorry, if your child does, that's great. But if he or she doesn't, please don't take away their self-confidence and dignity from them. Tell them it's okay. It's just an exam. They are cut out for much bigger things in life. Tell them no matter what they score, you love them, and you will not judge them. Please do this, and when you do, watch your children conquer the world. One exam or a low mark won't take away their dreams and talent. And please do not think that doctors and engineers are the only happy people in the world. With warm regards, some teacher in Singapore, I don't know. So, again, particularly for those of us who are sweating over our kids' finals right now, very important message to remember. The Sefer Chassidim writes, I found this to be fascinating. Chanoch l'naro pidarko ki gam ki yaskin lo yasum imene. Quotes the pasuk. Im tirosh yatzliach b'mikrav avol b'talmud, al titchok lo hashalum al talmud. If we find, and this is being used as a very simple sort of example, but I think if we just sort of process it, we can perhaps apply it in much more nuanced ways. If one sees that his child is succeeding in Mikra, which means in the broader sense, Chumash, Tanakh, of a lo b'talmud, but not when it comes to the study of Gemara. So don't push Gemara too much. Vim yavin Talmud, if the child understands Gemara, al titchok osalu lamdu Mikra, don't push Tanakh too much. B'mash yodea techanchehu. Where the child is succeeding, that should be the focus. Now, I understand that pedagogically, that's not necessarily the only or the preferred approach. If we're trying to teach kids how to grow and to develop and to acquire new skills and to push themselves to understand material that is challenging for them, so we should do so. But there may come a certain point in our child's educational development where it's clear that whether it's because of certain cognitive limitations or maybe it's because of certain interest, that the child is moving and pushing in one direction. And that's something that parents should respect and teachers should respect. Ben Chamesh Yisrael Talmud, Mayanaf Gemina, he says, when the Gemara says, the Mishnah, that when a child reaches 15 years old, it's time to study Gemara. What does that mean? Kevan Sha'adim Roash Ein Beno Zochla Talmud, Yumalo Halachos HaGadolos Medrashim HaKriya. It means that basically that's the age where your child should be learning. So if it's not working, if he's not succeeding there, then focus on other things. And don't try, again, just going back to the title, to take a round peg and, how's it go? Square peg in a round hole. Don't try to make it fit. Again, I'm not suggesting that we necessarily just run with this and apply it in its raw sense, the way it appears over here, but it is something for us to consider. And I know that many of us are sort of limited to a certain extent by the educational system that we all buy into, literally. And it's not perfect. I can tell you, I don't think anybody will tell you it's perfect. And one of the reasons where our educational system is far from perfect is because it does not yet allow for enough differentiation. I don't only mean in terms of instruction, but in terms of allowing kids to really find a place that is most fitting and most comfortable for them, the way they think, the way they learn, and to have an educational experience which is attractive and something which is meaningful. This is important in all areas of education, particularly so when it comes to the study of Torah, which we hope would not just be, you know, an intellectual exercise, not just looking for them to acquire knowledge, but as we say every day, Kihim Chayenu, we want Torah to be a source of joy and satisfaction and something which will be eternally meaningful to them. The next lesson in parenting challenging children, educate yourself regarding the factors that place children at risk. We speak today, it's not a new term, the concept of children at risk. Very often, when we speak about children at risk, we think automatically about teenagers. The reality is that often teenagers exhibit certain behaviors which make it very clear to us that they are at risk. There may be certain things that they're doing and things that they're not doing, which, you know, raise some very, very serious concerns. But the reality is that there can be children who are much younger than teenagers. You can have children who are 2 or 3 or 4 years old who may be at risk. That doesn't mean that you're in trouble, they're in trouble. It doesn't mean that there's, you know, a problem that can't be fixed. But it's important to become educated as to what are the sort of factors that would place certain children at risk. Because if I know that, then number one, I could be proactive in making sure that, you know, to whatever extent I can control the situation, my child is not placed in a setting which is unhealthy or perhaps in some ways detrimental to his or her development. And if it's not the kind of thing that I can change, so at least I know when to seek professional help. So here are some examples, and these are only examples. This is not supposed to be an exhaustive list of individual risk factors that certain kids may face. Number one, certain kids have biological vulnerability because of literally their biology. It's not something that they've done or even that you've done to them. It's just who they are. They are vulnerable. They have certain challenges in certain areas. Perhaps the most famous example that we speak about today is when it comes to ADD, ADHD. A lot of children today have difficulty sitting down and focusing, not only in class, not only in school, but that's where it presents most. If you don't know, you know, I would think it'd be worthwhile for everybody to study and to learn, even if you're this is not something you're dealing with as a parent. But it's fascinating to just understand the science. And it's not psychology. It's a mistake that people make when they think that ADHD is a psychological disorder. There are brain scans of kids who have ADHD or adults who have ADHD, and when you compare them to someone who doesn't, you see that there are very, very significant differences. Thankfully, this is not a death sentence, not at all. I mean, people can manage. In fact, there are studies that show that people who have ADHD in some ways can succeed and have an edge over the rest of the population. But this is, at least in the way that the expectations we have of our kids in our community, this is a certain vulnerability. And to be aware of it and to understand what it is. ODD, which stands for Oppositional Defiance Disorder, is different. It's not the same as ADD, but it is something which kids have, not all. And it doesn't just mean that the kid is undisciplined and the kid is a troublemaker or the kid doesn't know boundaries, but there are times where kids, because of their biological hardwiring, have a very, very difficult time being obedient, being compliant, and this is something that we should be aware of. There are kids who have certain vulnerabilities academically. They could have learning disabilities, and there are many, many different types of learning disabilities. I'm not going to name them. One in particular, which I guess maybe I'll get away with it because I see it not so much as a learning disability, but in a broader sense, having language processing difficulties. And the only reason why I separate this from learning disability is because if a child has difficulty processing language, so this is something which can lead to very concerning behaviors, even long before a child ever goes to school. Just being able to manage around the home and the way the child is interacting with other siblings or friends or parents, sometimes we would be completely clueless and would have no way of knowing that our child is actually just having a very, very difficult time understanding what we're saying. And there are very simple words and instructions that we use around the house without thinking twice about it. And there are children, adults as well, but children in particular who sometimes have these difficulties, obviously cannot express it, we don't know, and understanding that these are risk factors can sometimes help us be more proactive in helping them get the intervention that they need. Emotional and psychological vulnerabilities. There are certain people who, again, because of their emotional makeup, because of who they are going to be more vulnerable in certain areas. Psychiatric disorders often present very differently in younger children. We all have, and this is not a talk now about mental illness. We've actually presented on those topics in the past, and maybe we'll do so again. But suffice it to say that there is a lot of mistakes and myths that are very prevalent in the world when it comes to psychiatric disorders. But we all have in our mind sort of this idea of a psychiatrically compromised person. A child very often will not present in the same way. So, but you actually can have a child who is clinically depressed, but it won't present in the same way. But these are certain, again, vulnerabilities that children can have or challenges that they can have that we should be aware of. There could be, God forbid, a history of past or current abuse, a history of trauma. These are all potential risk factors which can cause children to be more challenging for us to raise. Examples of family risk factors are somewhat of a different set of concerns. Parental disciplinary style. Increased risk with parents that are overly permissive or overly strict. If you have a child that lives in a home in which parents do not discipline the child in an appropriate or balanced way, so this child is going to be more at risk. Many different types of risk, but this is a proven fact. Increased risk with marked inconsistency in parenting style. So if parents, one or both parents, basically are very erratic in their styles of parenting, and certainly don't mean to suggest that somebody has a bad day and screams at their kids, then that's it. Child's not at risk. Certainly not. But when there's a lot of instability in the home, and what we would call dysfunction, this is something that puts child at risk. High conflict divorce or severe marital conflict. I say high conflict divorce because actually research shows, and certainly not recommending divorce, but you may be surprised to know that research shows that children of divorced parents do not necessarily present to be more at risk than general population. When it's a high conflict divorce and there's a lot of fighting and it becomes very, very toxic, then that's a different story. But in a quote-unquote friendly divorce, or even, you know, one which there's mild conflict but not something which is off the charts, so kids seem to do, you know, well, and that's good to know because sometimes we fear the terrible fallout. Sometimes parents stay married, but there is a lot of conflict at home, and this is something that puts kids at risk. Parental depression or other serious mental illness in the home, ongoing family stress. So these are all different family risk factors. Dr. Pelkovitz and Rabbi Shimon Russell in a book called Timeless Parenting, this was published about 20 years ago, this book, there's some good articles in there. Wanted to read this to you. While reacting over emotionally to defiant behaviors in children can exacerbate their behavioral difficulties, the other side of the coin, not dealing with behavioral problems, is equally dangerous. Furthermore, when parents are unable to give their child a sense of consistent love and attention, they may place their child in danger of turning to acting out peer groups as substitute sources for unconditional love and acceptance. Lack of family cohesiveness and sufficient parental involvement and failure to adequately supervise a child are among the most commonly cited contributors to childhood hostility and defiance. For example, one study that followed children from early childhood to adulthood found that parents who connected to their children by spending time with them having discussions and caring enough to supervise their activities with friends were far more likely than other parents to raise children who were well-behaved and respectful. Notwithstanding the above, we urge parents, friends, and mechanchim to recognize that oftentimes poor parental treatment of this situation was the result of the problems and not its cause. Remember, al tadin es chavercha ad shetegiel mimkomo. Don't judge a person until you've been in their place. It is impossible to imagine the fear and pain felt by parents as the crisis develops within their home, and how that fear can cause even the best parents to err in their judgment of and reaction to their children's behavior. The more supportive and non-judgmental friends, family, and mechanchim are of parents going through a crisis with the child, the less the parents will feel ashamed and embarrassed, and their ability to deal with the situation will be enhanced. In other words, poor parenting that puts kids in a very compromised state. And sometimes, because of reasons that are completely beyond our control or our awareness, children act out in a certain way for a prolonged period of time, and it causes tremendous stress in the home. But we have to be very careful not to presume to know, you know, what is the cause and what is the effect. The fourth lesson for tonight of parenting challenging children is don't hesitate to seek professional guidance. Professional intervention can be exceedingly useful in promoting a positive plan and agenda forward. I didn't include here because, you know, maybe it should be obvious, and if not, you know, you can do your research, and I'm happy to discuss it with you offline as the different roles and the different types of professionals that can serve as parents in the school and out of the school. But needless to say, there are many, many different types of professional intervention which can be sought, and it can be exceedingly useful. People sometimes shy away from that and assume that it's not something which should be used unless the circumstances are completely, off the charts and warranted. But that's a mistake. Parents can benefit greatly from seeking their own professional guidance in raising challenging children. I recently had a conversation with a couple that is having difficulties with one of their children, and it is clear that that the problem, so to speak, is the child, not the parent. But at the same time, it seemed to me that the best thing that they could do for the family overall is just have the parents work with someone. And it was hard for this particular couple to accept that, at least initially. Because after all, if the problem is my kid, so why am I the one in therapy? But that's a very overly simplistic way of looking at the situation. Child is who he is. She is who she is. And, you know, for the moment anyway, there's not much we can do about that. But there's a lot that parents can do if they seek their own professional guidance as to how to properly parent such a child. It can have a dramatic change in terms of the entire dynamic in the home. Educational psychological evaluations can be invaluable in identifying the roots and challenges at either home or school. They can be invaluable. They can also be very expensive. And that's one of the reasons why people sometimes don't have their children evaluated. It's not something that's normally recommended for somebody, a child, if you're having no issues. It would be like, you know, going to a doctor and getting a full body scan, which may be very nice, but, you know, they tend to be very, very expensive. And if you're not having any symptoms, so most people don't do that. But educational and psychological testing is something which is really, really quite profound. I've seen it with my own eyes, and it's really, really quite remarkable that you can have a full psychological evaluation of a child who's 4, 5, 6 years old and take it out 20 years later and it could be like it was written yesterday. It doesn't mean that necessarily all the, you know, situations and the problems are the same, but we are a lot more predictable, and we're so much of our experience is sort of internally scripted, and we don't necessarily have the ability to decipher that on our own, but with people who know how to conduct such evaluations, they could really be very, very helpful in terms of plotting a path forward. We should make sure that the people we turn to for support are sufficiently informed and sensitive to the issues that we are challenged with and avoid screaming into echo chambers. I see this very often where people have difficulty with one or several of their children and they turn to the worst people for support. They turn to other people who are just having difficulty with their children and they're all screaming at each other all day about how difficult their children are. Of course, it's helpful and it feels good to vent sometimes, but that's not necessarily a productive outlet for support. And we should dafke go to people who are objective and people who are informed and people who know how to say, it sounds like it's a really tough situation. I don't really know how to help you, but it sounds like you should go to somebody who does. Those are, you know, the sort of places that we should go to for help. And finally, I would love it if you can help me putting an end to the social communal stigmatization of psychotherapeutic intervention and counseling. This is beyond this discussion, but, you know, people are often afraid to seek professional help whenever it involves, you know, sitting in a room and talking to somebody, particularly when we're dealing with children. We're afraid of what that means. Well, my child doesn't need therapy, and what's this going to mean? Shidduch, etc. The reality is that the stigmatization that exists, perhaps it's improved mildly, but it's shameful, because it really prevents many, many people from seeking the help that they need. And people can, as I said, really dramatically improve their lives if they would sort of grow up. And just like there's no stigma about going to a pediatrician when your child's ear hurts, there should be no stigma about going to seek professional counseling when your child is not ever behaving at home. And the final lesson of the evening, I think is the final one. Yes, have lots and lots of patience. We spoke about patience before, but of course, since we're speaking about challenging children tonight, it's kedai to just remind ourselves that we should always remember the following, that your child is not a finished product, and life is a journey. And just because my child is who he or she is today doesn't mean anything about tomorrow. Past performance is not indicative of future results. And that's sort of the flip side of this. And sometimes we look at other people and we're a little jealous. And sometimes we look at some of our other children and say, you know, why can't you be more like... hopefully we don't say that, but we may think it. But the reality is that nothing is a given in life. And just like kids who have challenges sometimes bounce back and ultimately, you know, do very well and succeed, sometimes kids who have very unremarkable upbringings and seem to just always be in the right place at the right time, and there were no issues whatsoever, and it was the most wonderful child to parent, something happens. You know, sometimes it's just a, you know, switch that flips, and things change. So, you know, we always require siyata d'shmaya. There are incredible stories about extraordinarily successful, well-adjusted, and fulfilled people who had turbulent and difficult childhoods. My mother was here, she would say, I'm one of them, but I would disagree. I'm not successful or well-adjusted. I'm somewhat fulfilled, but... don't forget the most important and often overlooked ingredient. Successful parenting is siyata d'shmaya, that we all need, divine assistance in every area of life. Parenting is an area in particular where we sometimes put tremendous faith in our own, you know, just our own thoughts and our own actions, and we presume to have a lot more control and power than we actually do. And just a reminder, and with this I will conclude, that there are several places where Chazal tell us that we should daven for success in general, and for children in particular, and for the success of our children. Now, the Chayyadam writes that, quoting the Mishnah Berurah, quotes from the Chayyadam, that when a person davens every day, and he says the word, Shelo Yomush HaTorah Mipi V'Zaro V'Zera Zaro, that's part of the davening, that a person should pray, that hopefully there should not be, he should have success in raising his family and his children. Of course, it is customary for women at the time of Hadlakas Neris Shabbos to daven that they should be matzliach in raising their children. But as we said before, there are never any guarantees. We can only do our part, and hopefully, Bezras Hashem, we will succeed in raising our challenging children in the most productive way. This coming Sunday will be the final feature in the series, Stepping In and Stepping Out, Stepping Aside, Inspiring Independence in a Scary World. Thank you again for joining. And look forward to seeing you on Sunday.